As part of our year-long series, Climate Connections, with National Geographic, NPR's been following more than 200 passengers aboard a pleasure ship to Antarctica. This kind of travel is sometimes called doomsday tourism. It's when people go to see natural beauty before it's gone for good. Antarctica's coastline is reportedly changing as warmer temperatures melt the ice. NPR's Gwen Tompkins reports that experiencing the continent changes people in a way that could help save it.
Here, at one of the finest cocktail lounges in the Antarctic Circle, Carol Hughes is sipping a mystery drink from a wine glass. It's after dinner on board a luxury cruise liner, and Hughes, an English clinical nurse, says whatever she's tasting is better than anything else she's had tonight.
It's lovely. It feels cleaner, much smoother. I'd say there's probably something in there, something to do with fish, I'd say.
What Carol Hughes doesn't know is that she's sipping an iceberg.
Is that the one that the penguin was walking over?
Antarctica, like every other continent, is too big to describe in one take. But Carol Hughes's remarks on melted iceberg water are an awfully good start. Antarctica is lovely. It does feel cleaner, and it has something to do with fish. Much of the continent remains a mystery, however, a cold and curious void. So most people learn the facts and fill in the rest with feeling. Every cabin on our ship has a book telling us how remote the continent is, what can live here, what can't. And yet all 159 pages amount to a single line of verse from the poet Pablo Neruda. There all ends and doesn't end. There all begins. Rivers and ice part. Air is married to snow.
Take some time and simply stop and reflect a little bit about what you're seeing, because it's pretty overwhelming.
Karen Strand is the expedition leader on our ship. She says put down your camera and get into the spirit of this place. You've got to appreciate the beauty, the loneliness, the unlikeliness of this continent that Aristotle suspected was here, but could never prove. Only a smidgen of the world's population has ever seen Antarctica. So Strand says that if you decide to come this far, don't blow it.
Unless you actually stop and take a look once in a while, you will miss it. Yes, of course you'll see it, but you won't see it. So to stop and just take it in. I mean, I'm Norwegian, and I thought that I had seen enough snow and ice for the rest of my life just living where I am. It's just incredible. It is a feeling. It's not like you can explain it with pictures or film, really. You just have to be there.
Many of the people who visit the perpetual winter of Antarctica are in the autumn of their lives. They want to unlock the mystery of the place. They also want to learn about the effects of climate change here, why the ice is melting. But more than anything, they want to have fun. Arun Patel is 70 years old. He walks with a cane. And at one of our last boat landings on the peninsula, Patel slid down a glacier on his tush.
It was like a roller coaster on your bum. One of the best rides I've ever had in my life. At age 70, you find something like this different. You know, it's wonderful. Wonderful, you know.
And that's not the only thing that got his backfield in motion. On the tail end of our voyage, the ship's crew put on an evening of entertainment that included music and lyrics by Usher, Little John, and Ludacris. There's something surreal about being on a boat in the near frozen middle of nowhere and listening to men talk about women in their birthday suits. But you know what they say, hip-hop is the poetry of the streets, even here, where there are no streets. Yeah. What the people on board the ship don't know is that they're testing an important scientific principle. Does the very act of observing something change it? In Antarctica, the answer is probably. Antarctica, so clean, so pure, is now a hot destination. Armadas of ocean liners are troubling her cool, heavy waters, and tourists are sharing terrain vital to the continent's wildlife. Again, Karen Strand.
Just looking on the impact that humans does wherever we go.
We have a sort of brutal way of imposing on nature, really, when we go somewhere. We destroy or we pollute, or we throw garbage around, and I think that's our prime aim here. Let's keep it as a wilderness.
That means if anyone drops so much as a plastic bag in the water, Strawn says the ship will turn around and retrieve it. Robin Steekstra is guiding a group of Americans on board the ship. She says Antarctic tourism has actually helped the continent. Bases that conduct scientific research along the coast have cleaned up their act.
I remember 20 years ago or so when you were coming down at some of these bases, they look like nothing more than dumps. The rusted material, the 20 or 30 years of rusting tin cans out back, the old machinery. We've had bases where they would go and pick up the penguin. You know, you want to see a penguin, they'd go pick them up. They were just pushing them out of their way. There wasn't this concern for the wildlife. But when people start visiting and seeing this, there's been an enormous change in the way the bases operate and the way the base conduct themselves regarding the environment and the wildlife. And that was largely due to visitors.
So the industry's bottom line appears to be that sometimes you've got to risk a little to get a lot. An international treaty prevents mining, drilling, and dumping here. But tour operators say that Antarctica also needs goodwill ambassadors for its continued protection. And people like Carol Hughes, the English nurse who drank from the iceberg, can make pretty poetic ambassadors.
It's just absolutely magical. I don't think I should be the same person when I get home. It really makes you feel so humble to think that this is such a wilderness and that we have to preserve it at all costs, really. It's a special place and we mustn't spoil it. Let's look after it.
After all, the best lines about Antarctica have been uttered by the people who've actually been here. Who said, glittering white, shining blue, raven black, in the light of the sun the land looks like a fairy tale? Roald Amundsen, the first explorer to reach the South Pole. That's who. And perhaps Fritz Klein said it best. He and his wife came here from York, Pennsylvania. Klein is no expert on the threat of climate change to Antarctica, but now more than ever, he's dead set against anything or anyone marring the beauty of the continent. How did he put it? Oh yeah, they better never. Gwen Tompkins, NPR News.
Antarctica is changing, though, and you can find out how in our video at npr.org/climateconnections. This is NPR News.
Before gay became homosexual and deer became Bambi, those words had different meanings. Gay was carefree and happy. Deer referred to any four-legged land animal. Over the years, words evolve. Their meanings broaden or break down depending on how they're used in popular culture. Saul Steinmetz has spent years following the transformations of the most basic words. He's a lexicographer and dictionary editor. His new book is Semantic Antics, How and Why Words Change Meaning. Saul Steinmetz is in our New York bureau. Hello to you.
Hello.
Tell us the ways that English language words shift in meaning or in connotation.
There are many ways. One very common one is specialization. For example, girl. To us, girl means only one thing. But at one point, originally in the early Middle Ages, girl meant a young child of any sex, what we called a boy or girl. That was the word for girl. What they used for what we now know as a girl, there was words like maid and maiden. And as those terms became more specialized, like we know that a maid is a young girl of a certain virtue, of a certain type, so then they started using girl to mean specifically a female child.
Our language, the English language, includes so many words that we borrow from other languages. I'm thinking of pajamas and garage and shampoo. Have their meanings changed as much over the years as some of the ones we've been talking about?
The tendency is in the English language, when you borrow a word, you usually keep the meaning the same as that of the borrowed language.
Uh-huh.
We don't change it. So garage, for example, you mentioned garage, is borrowed from French.
Mm-hmm.
The original meaning wasn't exactly what it is today. It was more of a hangar, like a place where you took vehicles and kept them there for a long time. It's not like the two-door garage of today.
Do you have some favorite words that have become so totally different from what they originally meant that they are unrecognizable?
Unrecognizable? Oh, my gosh. Many, many, many words. Let me think of one at least. Meticulous. Meticulous comes from Latin meticulosus, and it meant fearful, timid. And the reason it changed to mean what it is now, that is very careful and fussy, is because people who are fearful and timid tend to be very careful with what they do. And therefore, eventually, it developed into the idea of a meticulous worker is one who is extremely careful about details.
There are words that we so often misuse or misunderstand, and one that I'm thinking of is disinterested and uninterested.
It totally reversed its meaning. Today, we say that disinterested can only be applied to someone who is impartial, while uninterested means not having any interest in something. But originally, it was just the opposite. So what happened was that over the years, the meanings of these words changed around, although to this day, some people use disinterested to mean not impartial, but uninterested.
Yeah.
If you notice, the prefixes are dis and on. These prefixes are very confusing. They both mean basically a negative of some form. So if it's a negative of some form, there's no reason why people shouldn't use one instead of the other to imply negativity.
Sure.
Which is what they do, of course.
And make them interchangeable when that's not correct.
Right. Yeah. But, of course, critics will always criticize. They will write long criticisms about the misuse of these words.
And most of us will misunderstand what they've written.
Miss is right.
Thank you so much, Saul.
You're very
Steinmetz's
welcome.
New book is called Semantic Antics. Nice to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Susan.
You can read about how words like wallop, weird, and worry have changed meanings over the years at npr.org/books. That bit of music is part of a cantata, an Italian term for a work that usually involves a chorus and an orchestra. But this cantata is not in Italian, or German, or even French. It's inspired by a Native American language that has not been spoken in decades. The production is based on the oral history of a California woman who was one of the last members of her tribe to speak that language. Now an opera singer and a composer have teamed up to put her oral history to music. From member station KQED, Sasha Coca brings us the story.
Joseph Mondragon was just 8 years old when a man with an olive-green soldier's coat came to live in his family's basement in Monterey. The year was 1929.
Grandma told him that she knew he was coming. She felt it. She had a premonition that he was coming to open the gates for our people. Let the Caucasians know the Indian way, the history of our people, which nobody knew for a long time.
The man was John Peabody Harrington, a linguist from the Smithsonian who spent 4 decades gathering notes on native languages spoken from Alaska to South America. He'd come to record the oral history of Mondragon's dying grandmother, Ascensión Solórzano de Cervantes. She was a famous herbal healer and the last fluent speaker of Mutsun, the language of the Amamutsun tribe that lived near California's central coast. Today, her grandson Mondragon is 86 years old, and he's sharing his own memories of Ascension with a different kind of translator.
Oh, I see.
He'll start out with her photo,
And then these are the baskets.
Yeah, I see them, yeah.
And then this is hers that's in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, this is the one she made.
Mezzo-soprano Helene Joseph Weil is a music professor at California State University, Fresno. She first learned about Ascension Solórzano 20 years ago when she saw a picture of her in the San Francisco Chronicle.
And I was so moved by it, and there was something about her photo that just mesmerized me that I suddenly said, I have to sing her. How can I sing her?
Joseph Weil adapted Ascension's oral history into a libretto, which award-winning composer Benjamin Boone set to music.
And now it seems to me a curious thing that if the scientists desired so much to know the San Juan language, that they waited until all those that talked it best were dead and finished.
She trusted Harrington. As she said in one of her quotes, direct quotes to him, it's a curious thing that the Americans waited until all those that were dead and finished to find out about the tribes and their language, and then they just came and scribbled on any old thing. But she said, together, you and I are going to make that right.
In this scene, called Lamentation, composer Benjamin Boone tries to express the horror of Native American genocide through wide leaps in the choral parts, dramatic sounds that are almost discordant.
Hide in the hollows of the tree.
The cantata has won the praise of historians, musicians, and Native American scholars, like UC Davis professor Martha Macri. She's spearheading an effort to digitize the oral histories collected by Smithsonian linguist J.P. Harrington. She says setting these histories to music is an innovative idea, and one she thinks Helene Joseph Weil has handled respectfully.
It's not someone trying to imitate Native culture and pretend. She has really taken her great respect and regard for Ascension and translated it into an art form that is her art form. It can seem quite incongruous, but in fact, she's presenting Ascension's words and life to an audience that might otherwise not come across it.
For the aria depicting Ascension's death, Joseph Weil and Boone made the first recording of the bells of Mission San Juan Bautista. Boone arranged the sound of the bells to accompany a centuries-old Gregorian chant discovered in the mission archives. That's fitting since Ascension was buried in the mission cemetery, home to some 4,000 Native American graves. Ascension Solórzano's descendants say they hope the new cantata highlighting her oral history will bring attention to their tribe. Although Ascension Solórzano was likely the last fluent speaker of the Amamutzun language, there are some 600 tribal members alive today, and they're still struggling for federal recognition. For NPR News, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
You can see an audio slideshow about Ascension at npr.org/music. It must be a universal truth. At some point, everybody dreams of being a rock star. You string together a few musicians, a few notes, hopefully a few bucks. You practice in the garage. And what next? The New York City band Spottiswood and His Enemies has been doing that what next part for 10 years now. They are not mainstream, and they don't strive to be, but they're a staple of the New York club scene. Here's Muscle Man from their latest album, Salvation.
The Muscle Man, he walked in and he beat you. He didn't even try. Money boys, who were so keen to meet you, didn't even wave goodbye.
Don't fade away.
Spottiswood and His Enemies just celebrated their 10th anniversary with a show at Joe's Pub in New York, and they released two albums to commemorate the big anniversary, That's What I Like and Salvation. Jonathan Spottiswood, lead man for the eponymous, I always wanted to use that word on the radio, band Spottiswood and His Enemies, joins us now from our studios in New York. Hi.
Hello, Susan.
You didn't bring your enemies along? What's the matter, you chicken?
No, I try to avoid them as much as possible.
So this band just releases two albums. One was not enough?
No. In fact, five would have been too few, but we ran out of resources.
But just tell us about that process, because somebody told me that you and your band recorded 29 songs on these two new albums. And how long did it take you to do that?
We actually went in and recorded 33 songs in 6 days, and then we cut a few out. We did a little bit of extra overdubs after that, but the bulk of it was recorded in 6 days.
Yeah. Wow. But do you get any sleep, Jonathan Spottiswood? Because how could you do that much writing?
The writing's the easy part. Everything else is difficult.
What do you mean?
I mean, well, working with my band is lovely, and rehearsing is nice, and recording isn't so bad, but the dealing with manufacturing, duplication, you know, the music business, all of that tiresome stuff. That's the hard part.
Yes, I'm sure. Well, right now you're in our studio in New York. Would you play something for us?
I'm going to play an old song of ours. They're building a road from the moon to the sun. Then they'll build another road. Yeah, when that road is done. They're working so hard, but they've only just begun building that road from the moon to the sun. And everybody wants to succeed. And everybody longs to be free. And everybody's looking for love. So they're building a road from the moon to the sun. Yeah, they're building a road from the moon to the sun.
Jonathan Spottiswood, I want to ask you about one of the lyrics, Everybody Wants to Succeed. And you've certainly had some of the joys of fame. You played Lincoln Center. You had some write-ups in the New Yorker magazine. You work this full-time. Some of your band members have day jobs. Do you consider yourself successful, Mr. Spottiswood?
Depends on the day.
Huh.
I think the song, I didn't realize when I wrote it, became a parody of the journey that I'm on with my band, because it's a difficult road, and I feel incredibly blessed and successful. I've kept these amazing musicians together for the last 10 years, and we put out records, and I'm doing my work, and that's all an artist can ask for. But sometimes it's difficult. It's difficult, and scraping a living is not so easy.
The difficulties are getting bookings, having tours.
Yeah, all the different things, you know, trying to make money doing your art. And I mean, I think that's something that maybe there was an illusion that was created in the 50s and 60s and 70s where there were these huge bands making tons of money. And there still are a few. But I think maybe the old-fashioned way where you just, you're an itinerant musician and you depended on the kindness of strangers is maybe that's the path again these days as things kind of implode. And as long as I've got my enemies around me, I'm fine.
A man is only as good as the strength of his surrounding enemies.
Eh? Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's listen to one of the songs from the album now. Title track, That's What I Like.
Sly ones in strippers, shy ones in slippers, that's what I like. Farmers' daughters, engineers' wives, girls who throw parties, girls who throw knives, spinsters who've made the most of their lives, that's what I like.
I love the list, although it does tend to include everything, right? Big old fat ones, ladies from Boston with college degrees, what's the rest? Knobbly knees, pimples?
Yeah, it's funny. When I wrote the song, I thought that women wouldn't like it, wouldn't like this song, but I've actually found that they really do. Anyone who doesn't feel conventionally beautiful seems to like the song, and it's actually even become a lesbian anthem in New York. Who knew?
So that's what I like. Brunettes, redheads, feminists, deadheads. That's what I like.
You get a very interesting sound. Sometimes it just sounds almost like it's in a bathtub on a bad phone line. Excuse me, I don't mean to. I'm not being insulting. I just mean it's such an intriguing, sometimes old-fashioned sound.
I like to think some of it actually sounds easy to listen to, but all the songs, the band, the producer, we serve the song. So if it makes sense for the narrative of the story, then, you know, we'll put it in a bathtub, we'll put it on the beach, anywhere.
Let's hear another song from this album. You call it Sailing to Byzantium.
Soldiers are eating caviar from a samovar. Don't know who they are. Pheasants and capers, Turkish delight. Women dressed in white on a moon.
This is a dying soldier's dream, and you're imagining him as a participant in a major World War I battle.
Sometimes when you write a song, you only figure out what it's about as it, you know, when you're three quarters of the way through it. The last verse, I realized, you know, that it was from a perspective of a soldier who was dying, and so then I imagine he's lying on the fields of Passchendaele dying, and these are memories coming back to him as he's about to die.
And the writing, flowers are blooming and so are the dead, and furrows of blood through fading eyes.
My grandfather fought in the First World War, and he got a bullet through his bayonet, a bullet through his helmet, but he survived, luckily.
Yeah.
Flowers are blooming and so are the dead. Meadows are red in paradise. Steeples and scarecrows and wheels in the mud. Furrows of blood through fading eyes.
Did it ever occur to you, Mr. Spottiswood, to have chosen maybe an easier path? You were talking about how tough it is. Or do you feel you are, for all the rough spots, living the dream?
And the nightmare, yes. My mother's been a very, you know, obviously very influential. And her message to me has always been to follow your heart, follow your passion. And it never takes you exactly where you want it to go. But, it, you know, at least you don't regret the fact that you followed it.
Jonathan Spottiswood, lead man for the band Spottiswood and His Enemies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we say goodbye to you, will you play one more song for us?
Yeah, I'll play a sweeter song.
Well, the fog's coming down and the moon is a blur. And you want something to eat, so you're wandering the streets in the pouring rain. And your friends are all there, with a girl on each arm, laughing, smoking cigarettes, and you're all soaking wet in the pouring rain. And everyone is smiling, everyone is beautiful. And there's a silver lining, silver lining in your soul. And everything is shining, everything is beautiful. Oh, oh, oh. All the policemen are drunk, though the night's just begun. The whole city's gonna drown, and the wind will blow you down in the pouring rain. And
And everyone is smiling, everyone is beautiful. And there's a silver lining, silver lining in your soul. And everything is shining, everything is beautiful. Oh, oh. Girl at your side holds your umbrella high. She's got everything you need, and her kisses are so sweet in the pouring rain. In the pouring rain. In the pouring rain.
More music from the new albums of Spottiswoode and His Enemies, plus some new artists. Find them at our music website, npr.org/music. And you can hear Weekend Edition Saturday any day of the week if you subscribe to our At Your Leisure podcast at npr.org/podcasts. This is Weekend Edition. I'm Susan Stamberg. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Susan Stamberg. When your stock in trade is your voice, the slightest tickle in the back of your throat is enough to make you scream, in your mind anyway. Just ask any actor, politician, play-by-play announcer, or, at the risk of jinxing ourselves, radio host. NPR's Rob Sachs decided to ask somebody who would know best, an opera singer.
Meet Jennifer Wilson.
Basically, people have been telling me that I'm noisy all my life.
She's been a professional singer since 1991, a soloist since 2002, and from an early age growing up in D.C., she knew the opera was the perfect place for her robust voice. But outside the opera house, Jennifer's voice is a more moderate tenor. You'd never notice she was packing that much heat.
Many actors don't speak any word that they aren't being paid for. And with singers, it has to be sort of the same thing because our voices are livelihood.
Nearly all operas are performed without microphones, so it's up to Jennifer to use her own voice to fill out those big opera houses. Add to that, she sometimes has to project herself over a 120-piece orchestra playing at full tilt. So you can imagine she'll do anything to protect her voice. And it goes a lot further than just drinking a warm cup of tea, which can actually have the opposite effect.
Because any caffeinated beverage is going to cause your vocal cords to dry out eventually.
So she has a routine.
I take 200 to 400 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 per day to keep my immune system in top form.
Unfortunately, that's not working right now.
I'm suffering from a cold at the moment, as you may be able to hear. Excuse me.
So she uses a humidifier at home and the next best thing when she's out of town.
In Santa Fe, when I was there, we had swamp coolers rather than air conditioners that actually dispersed water vapor into the air as a fan blew behind it.
And come performance time, things get even more extreme.
I avoid noisy restaurants, you know, no rock concerts, no sporting events. I mean, I really try to avoid speaking to the extent that I have actually carried around a piece of paper and a pencil.
One thing she hasn't had, though, is laryngitis, which can be deadly for any opera production since performances mostly just run a few weeks and often without the benefit of understudies. So when someone actually does come down with laryngitis, it's pretty common to have a backup singer sing from the orchestra pit while the main actor lip-syncs on stage. And there are even other ways to improvise.
I did attend a performance, which is sort of legendary, where in La Boheme, the Marcello was sick. And the fellow who knew the role, he ended up singing both his role and Marcello's role from the stage. In fact, the original Marcello was on the stage mouthing and acting his part while the other fellow sort of surreptitiously sang, pretending to be reading a book or something. And then when his time to sing his part would come, he would step up and sing his role.
Well, Jennifer has never had to do anything like that, but she can relate to the idea of playing two parts at once. As the lead soprano for the Washington National Opera's current production of The Flying Dutchman, Jennifer gets to be the prima donna on stage, but off stage, she has to shut down her boisterous pipes to preserve them for the next performance. And while being the glass-breaking shrieking type, Jennifer says playing this other role has helped her develop an unexpected skill set.
You know, it does make you a diplomat, because if you don't have the volume at your disposal, then you have to find another way.
If Jennifer ever really does lose that amazing voice, maybe there's a second career out there for her in the Foreign Service. Rob Sachs, NPR News.
I am an opera singer. I stand on painted tape. It tells me where I'm going and where to throw my cape. I call my co-star's brother. I call my co-star.
Cargo pilots are a renegade breed, fiercely proud of being maverick, tough-as-nails flyers. They crisscross the globe in aging jumbo jets, hauling everything from luxury cars to giraffes to condoms. These freight dogs, as they like to be called, are also essential cogs of the global economy. Freelance journalist Michael Walker recently profiled this intense, often bizarre line of work in an article called Anything, Anywhere, Anytime. It runs in the March issue of Men's Vogue magazine. Mr. Walker joins us from the studios of NPR West. Hello to you.
Hello.
You spent a lot of time around several cargo pilots, and I wonder what they're like. Do they have spiffy blue uniforms and wear caps with peaks?
They have them. They tend to, when they get on the plane, they tend to shed those and just use their and work in their civilian clothes. It's a real point of difference between the two cultures of the passenger airline pilot and the cargo airline pilot. The cargo airline pilot likes to think of himself as sort of the anti-passenger pilot in every way. And one of the guys told me, he said, look, it's a completely different culture. He was saying that, you know, the airline pilot likes to walk to the airport and he's in his uniform and the wife is going, boy, he looks good in that uniform. The little boy is going, you know, boy, I wish I could do that. And the father's going, boy, I wish I had his life. He goes, us? He goes, we come in the back door. So these guys have a real sense of independence. One guy, is a great thing, he says, look, my job is I work for a company that gives me a $150 million airplane, and me and two friends go and fly it around the world, and the only thing they ask is to get the cargo there on time and not crash the plane. There's not very much oversight for these guys. They really are on their own, and they love it.
Yeah. Describe a typical cargo flight, where they go, what they're carrying, how long it lasts.
Time pressure is very intense. I mean, it's a brutally competitive industry, and if you know the penalties that the airline, the cargo airline, will pay if the cargo arrives not in time, can be substantial. They can lose the contract. So the pressure on these guys to always get the stuff there on time is very intense. They'll fly from Los Angeles to Hawaii. They'll take a load of cattle that will be flown to Hawaii to graze on the grasslands there, then flown back later on. And when they take off the plane, one guy told me that the cattle are back there standing up in their pens, and you'll feel them sort of like moving their feet side by side to keep their balance as he takes off. That same guy told me that when they were coming in one time after delivering the cattle, they were coming in for their landing, and cattle doing what cattle do for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours created some level of, I think, methane gas at the top of the fuselage of the plane, which condensed into water. And so when they nosed the plane over, all of a sudden this water came running down the ceiling into the cockpit. It's raining on these guys. They're covering up all their instruments. That sort of stuff. They'll be out for 38 or 40 days sometimes on these things.
Yeah. I understand that you logged some time in a cargo flight simulator in Miami. I bet that was a whole lot of fun.
Oh, it was amazing. It was the pilot was Mike Yannencombe, was a DC-8 cargo pilot. And so the simulator I was in was the actual cockpit of a real DC-8. With the windows blacked out and covered with video monitors.
Well, we have some audio from that simulator session. Let's listen.
Well, you're lined up with us on a highway. If you want to land there, that's fine. But
what are you doing? You're landing?
Yeah, he's lined me up to land at Miami International Airport, but I've lined up on a highway next to the actual runway instead. This is a problem.
Just to the left of there is the runway.
Wow, I'm glad it was a simulator, huh?
Yeah, I turned away from that, unfortunately, pretty late. The rest of it didn't go very well.
Are these cargo pilots a dying breed of aviators?
No, but the milieu in which they operate is changing. It's right now the industry supports smaller operators, independent operators, but it's increasingly beginning to be dominated by Federal Express and UPS. And with that, some of these really old aircraft are very fuel inefficient. They're being retired, and so flying a DC-8 is a very difficult plane to fly if you've grown up flying modern aircraft, because it's a lot of manual control. You really have to know your stuff. And that's what these guys really take enormous pride in, that they're kind of like the last true aviators. So as those aircraft are retired and the business probably inevitably consolidates, you're going to see, I think, some of the romance of it, if that's the right word, will begin to fade. So I really thought when I wrote this story, it was chronicling, I think, sort of, the twilight of this culture.
Hmm. Freelance journalist Michael Walker, his article on cargo pilots called Anything, Anywhere, Anytime, appears on the Men's Vogue website. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.